When a shuttle bearing the Guild Legate and the Choa Mentat Auditor arrived from Carthag, Sardaukar escorts brought the two visitors to Shaddam's opulent cabin. Both men reeked of melange. "We are finished, sire." Shaddam poured himself a glass of honey-sweet Caladan wine. Across the table, Zum Garon sat with rigid military posture, as if he were about to be interrogated. The Guild Legate and Mentat Auditor remained silent until the cabin door was sealed shut. The Mentat stepped forward first, holding out a scribing pad onto which he had transferred the mental summary of his results. "Baron Vladimir Harkonnen has committed a profusion of transgressions. He has allowed numerous purported mistakes to remain uncorrected. We have proof of his missteps, as well as details that show he attempted to conceal his manipulations from us." "As I suspected." Shaddam listened while the auditor gave him a synopsis of the illegal activities. Garon allowed his anger to show. "The Emperor has already established that he is willing to enact severe punishment for such misdeeds. Does the Baron not know of Zanavar or Corona?" Shaddam took the summary pad from the Mentat auditor and scanned the text and numbers. None of it would mean much to him unless he sat for hours with an interpreter, something he had no intention of doing. He had been convinced of the Baron's guilt from the outset. "We have clear evidence of crimes against the Imperium," the legate said, sounding oddly uneasy. "Unfortunately, sire, we did not find what we sought." Shaddam held up the scribing pad. "What do you mean? Does this not show how House Harkonnen broke Imperial law? Does he not deserve to be punished?" "It is true that the Baron stockpiled spice, doctored production numbers, and avoided Imperial taxes. But we have tested sample after sample of the spice in Harkonnen shipments and cargo facilities. Every scrap of melange is pure, with no evidence of tainting." The albino legate hesitated. Shaddam looked impatient. "This is not what we expected, sire. We know from our analysis that the navigators in our lost highliners died from contaminated spice gas. We also know that samples taken from the liquidated Bayekal stockpile of melange were chemically corrupt. Therefore, we had expected to discover impurities here on Arrakis, inert substances used by the Baron to extend the quantity of melange while diluting its quality, thereby introducing the subtle poisons that resulted in several disasters." "But we found nothing of that nature," the Mentat concluded. The Supreme Bashar leaned forward, his hands locked in a double fist. "Nevertheless, we still have enough evidence to remove House Harkonnen." The Guild Legate inhaled deeply, bowing his nose closer to the diffuser collar. "Quite so, but that will not answer our questions." Shaddam formed his lips into what he hoped was a concerned frown. He wished Fenring could be here to watch this, but even now his spice minister should be preparing the initial shipments of Amal. Pieces were fitting into place nicely. "I see. Well, nevertheless, the Bashar and I will determine a suitable response," he said. Within a few days, the matter would be moot. He stared down at the Mentat's scribing pad. "We must study this information. Perhaps my personal advisors can offer a theory to explain the altered spice." Knowing his emperor's moods, and sensing that the two guests were dismissed, Zum Garon rose from the table and began to usher them out. After the door sealed again, Shaddam turned to his Supreme Bashar. "As soon as the shuttle has returned to its highliner, I want you to sound battle stations throughout the fleet. Dispatch my warships and take up positions within direct firing range of Carthag, Arrakeen, Arsunt, and every other population center on the planet." Garonne received this bombshell with a stony expression. "Just like on Xanavar, sire?" "Precisely." Issuing no warning, the Sardaukar armada descended from the highliners until they scraped the atmosphere of Arrakis. Their weapons ports opened and glowed with a readiness to strike. Shaddam sat on the command bridge, issuing orders and making pronouncements into a hollow recorder, more for his memoirs and posterity than for anything else. "Baron Vladimir Harkonnen has been found guilty of high crimes against the Empire. Independent Choam auditors and guild inspectors have uncovered incontrovertible evidence to support this judgment. As I demonstrated on Xanavar and Corona, my law is the law of the Imperium. Carino justice is swift and complete." The guild would undoubtedly assume he was bluffing at first, but they were in for a rude surprise. With his forces already dispersed, once the reign of destruction began, it would take his Sardaukar little time to blacken the desert world and obliterate all melange. Guild navigators required huge quantities of spice. The Bene Gesserit were steady customers as well, consuming increasing amounts each year as their numbers grew. Most of the Landsraad was addicted. The Imperium could never do without the substance. "I am their emperor, and they will do as I say." Even without the advice of Count Fenring, he had thought this over carefully, considering all possibilities. Once he destroyed Arrakis, what could the guilds do? Leave in their ships and strand him here? They wouldn't dare. Then they would never receive a single gram of synthetic spice. He signed off and began the countdown to full bombardment. "Things will be different in the Imperium after this." My life ended the day that Tleilaxu invaded this world. All these years of fighting back, I have been a dead man, with nothing more to lose. Keter Pilru, Secret Journals, Fragment. Skirmishes continued underground among the Ixion manufactories and technological centers. The Suboids, their anger and frustration unleashed, tore uniforms from slain Sardaukar soldiers, grabbed weapons, and fired indiscriminately, destroying the few remaining production lines. Behind Romber, a Tleilaxu statue erected to honor the invaders had been decapitated in the fighting, and fragments of its alloy head lay scattered about on the pavement. This will never end. Allied with Ixion rebels, Atreides' troops had succeeded in retaking the stalactite buildings, the tunnels, and the Grand Palais itself. Pockets of frenzied Sardaukar fought on the open cavern floor, where House Vernius had once built highliners. The bloodshed did not seem to ebb. "We need another ally," Keter suggested. "If we can prove that flawed artificial spice resulted in the deaths of two navigators, including my brother, the Spacing Guild will stand with us." "They have already said as much," Romber said. "But we had thought to complete this action without their interference." Gurney looked concerned. "The Guild isn't here, and we can't bring them fast enough." Keter's dark eyes gleamed, bloodshot, but full of determination. "I might be able to." He led them to a small warehouse that appeared abandoned. Romber watched while Keter lovingly removed the hodgepodge construction of his Rogo transmitter from a locked storage container. The strange device appeared stained and singed, with evidence of frequent repairs. It was studded with crystalline power rods. His hands trembled as he held it. "Even I don't know exactly how this thing works. It's configured to the electrochemistry of my own mind, and I was able to communicate with my twin brother. We shared a bond once. Although his brain changed and passed far beyond any definition of humanity, I could still understand him." Memories of Demur welled up in him like tears, but he drove them back. His hands trembled on the controls. Now my brother is dead, and our Rogo is damaged. This is the last crystal rod, one that was somehow repaired in my last communication with Demur. Perhaps, if I use sufficient power, I can send at least a whisper to other navigators. They might not understand all of my words, but they may hear the urgency. Romber was overwhelmed by everything happening around him. He had not envisioned anything like this, and said, "If you can bring the guild here, we will do our best to show them what Shaddam has been doing behind a cloak of secrecy." Kater squeezed Romber's artificial arm so hard that the cyborg sensors detected the pressure. "I have always been willing to do whatever is necessary, my prince. If I can help, it would be my greatest honor." Romber saw a strange determination in the man's eyes, an obsession that went beyond rational thought. "Do it." Kater grabbed electrode leads and attached sensors to his scalp, the back of his head, and his throat. "I don't know the capacity of this device, but I intend to use all the energy I can pump through it and through me." He grinned. "This will be a shout of triumph and a cry for help, my loudest message to the outside." When the Rogo was fully powered, Kater took a deep breath for courage. In the past, he always spoke aloud during transmissions to Demur, but he knew his brother did not actually hear the words. Instead, the navigator picked up the thoughts that accompanied the speech. This time, Kater would say nothing out loud, and would instead concentrate all of his energy on projecting his thoughts across the vast distances. Pressing a transmit button, he sent a fusillade of thought, a volley of desperate signals directed to any guild navigator who could hear, a cosmic mayday. He didn't know whether the Rogo or his brain would fail first, but he felt them connecting and reaching out. Kater's jaw clenched, his lips drew back, and his eyes squeezed shut until tears flowed from them. Sweat poured from his forehead and temples. His skin turned ruby red. Blood vessels bulged at his temples. This transmission was exponentially more powerful than anything he had ever attempted with Demur. But this time, he did not have the inexplicable mental connection of his twin. Romber saw Kater dying from the effort, literally killing himself in a great final attempt to use the transmitter. The haggard rebel screamed soundlessly inside his skull. Before they could disconnect him, the Rogo transmitter sparked and burned. The machine overloaded, and its circuits fused. The crystal rods shattered into black snowflakes. Kater's face bore a strangled expression. His features tightened, as if in unspeakable pain. Synapses melted inside his brain, preventing him from uttering a sound. With his one remaining hand, Romber yanked the sensor leads from the rebel's head and neck, but Kater collapsed to the floor of the storage chamber. His teeth chattered, his body twitched, and his smoking eyes never opened again. "He's gone," Gurney said. In a deep well of sadness, Romber cradled the fallen rebel, this most loyal of all people who had ever served House Vernius. "After such a long fight, sleep in peace, my friend. Rest well on free soil." He stroked the cooling skin. The cyborg prince stood, his scarred face more grim than ever, and made his way out of the storage chamber, followed by Gurney Halleck. Romber did not know if Kater's transmission had succeeded, or how the guild might respond to the call across space, if they heard it at all. But unless they received reinforcements soon, the day's battle might be for naught. The Ixian nobleman spoke in a deep, implacable voice to the Atreides fighters around him. "Let us finish this." To produce the genetic alteration of an organism, place it in an environment which is dangerous, but not lethal. Tleilaxu Apocrypha. After the messy death of Haidar Phenagidica, Count Fenring saw the Atreides troops actually winning their battle against the Imperial Sardaukar. A most disturbing development. It astonished him that after so many years, Duke Leto Atreides would authorize such a blatant military move. Perhaps the family tragedies that would have crushed any other man had actually galvanized him into action. Still, it was a brilliant surprise strategy, and these Ixion facilities would be an impressive economic prize for a great house like Atreides. Even after decades of Tleilaxu mismanagement and detrimental maintenance, Fenring couldn't believe Duke Leto would just blithely hand them over to Prince Romber. On the comm screen of the research pavilion, Fenring watched Atreides soldiers approaching the complex. That left him with little time to accomplish what was necessary. He had to erase all evidence of Project Amal and his own culpability. The Emperor would seek a scapegoat for the research debacle, and Fenring was determined that he would not fill that role. Master researcher Agitica had failed spectacularly, and now lay smashed among the bovine bodies of brain-dead women. Several bloated axolotl females, still connected to tubes in their coffin-like boxes, had fallen around the little man in a parody of bizarre sexuality. Agitica's stigmata-studded body might serve one final purpose. The remaining Tleilaxu scientists were frightened. The Sardaukar had rushed to the main battle and abandoned them here in the research pavilion. Knowing the Count was the Emperor's official representative, the Tleilaxu looked to him for advice. Some of them might even believe he, Fenring, was the face dancer replica Zoal, as Agitica had originally planned. Maybe they would follow his orders, at least for a short time. Fenring stood on the catwalk and raised his hands in much the way Agitica had done before his histrionic demise. Foul odors bubbled up from the smashed axolotl tanks, including the thick stench of human waste products. "We are left defenseless," he shouted. "But I have an idea that may save you all, The surviving researchers stared up at him with uncertainty bordering on hope. Fenring knew the layout of the research pavilion, and his eyes flicked back and forth. "You are all too valuable for the Emperor to risk losing you." He directed the scientists to a secure laboratory chamber that had only one exit. "You must take shelter there and remain hidden. I will bring reinforcements." He counted 28 researchers, though a few others must be trapped in outlying administrative buildings. Ah well, the mobs would take care of them. Fenring scuttled down from the catwalk to the main floor. When the doomed scientists had crowded into the single chamber, he stood in the doorway, smiling. "No one can get to you here." "Shh!" He nodded and then sealed the door. "Leave it to me." The foolish little men didn't even imagine something was amiss until he had walked halfway across the broad floor of the pavilion. He ignored their muffled shouts and fist hammerings. Those researchers probably knew every detail about the Amal program. To keep them from talking, he might have been inconvenienced by having to kill each one of them. This way, he could take care of the problem much more efficiently, with minimal effort. As Imperial Spice Minister, he was, after all, a busy man. The lab floor and the support systems for the axolotl tanks were filled with canisters of biological hazards, flammable substances, acids, and explosive vapors. He donned a breathing filter apparatus from an emergency station on one wall. A man of many talents, he moved through the chamber like a dervish, dumping fluids, mixing liquids, releasing deadly gases. He paid little heed to the twitching female bodies in disarray on the floor, grossly re-engineered by the Tleilaxu to produce synthetic spice. So close. Ajitika's plan had almost worked. Fenring stopped by the sightless husk of the fertile young woman who had been Christine, the Bene Gesserit commando. He studied her naked flesh. Her abdomen bulged outward. The uterus stretched into a factory designed to serve Tleilaxu purposes. Nothing more than a machine now, a chemical facility. As he gazed upon Christine's waxy face, Fenring thought of his remarkably beautiful wife, Margaret, still on Kytane, no doubt gossiping at court and sipping tea. He looked forward to getting back to her and relaxing in her arms. This sister Christine would never send her damning report back to Wallach 9, and Fenring would not let any detail slip, not even to his wife. He and Margaret loved each other deeply, but that didn't mean they would share all of their secrets. Fenring heard military activity outside the buildings as Atreides' forces encountered the remaining floor-level Sardaukar. The Imperial troops would hold them off for a while. Long enough. He strolled to the high-arched outer chambers and turned back to look at the chaos in the laboratory. Smashed canisters, puddled noxious fluids, bubbling gases, bodies, tanks. From here, he could no longer hear the desperate pounding of the Tleilaxu scientists locked inside their death trap. Count Fenring tossed an igniter over his shoulder, deep into the facility. The gases and chemicals burst quickly into flames, but he had time to depart with his usual lounging gait. Concussions boomed behind him. The laboratories burned in his wake, destroying the axolotl tanks, the Amal research, and all evidence. But Fenring didn't bother to hurry. The research pavilion exploded as Duncan Idaho and his men penetrated the Imperial barricades, allowing the Atreides soldiers to charge forward. A tremendous boom echoed through the facility, and everyone took cover. Debris spouted through the roof of the pavilion like a volcanic eruption. The inner walls collapsed. Within moments, the lab complex became an inferno of melted glass, plasteel, and flesh. Duncan held his men back from the growing fire. His heart sank to know that all proof of the Tleilaxu crimes was being incinerated. Roiling brown and orange vapors spewed upward, toxic smoke that could kill them as surely as the flames themselves. The swordmaster saw a lean, broad-shouldered man stride out, totally unconcerned. His silhouette was muscular against the orange wall of heat. The man removed a breathing apparatus from his face and tossed it aside. He held a short fighting sword, such as the Sardaukar carried. Duncan raised the old Duke's blade in a defensive posture, stepping forward to block this man's passage. Count Hasimir Fenring came forward without hesitation. "Aren't you going to cheer the fact that I've escaped, Cause for celebration, I'd say. My friend Shaddam will be overjoyed." "I know you," Duncan said, remembering his months of political instruction on a sun-drenched island on the Ginaz archipelago. "You're the fox who hides behind the Emperor's cape and commits dirty work for him." Fenring smiled. "A fox? I've been called a weasel and a ferret before, but never a fox. I have been held here against my will. Those evil Tleilaxu researchers meant to perform terrible experiments on me." His large eyes widened. "I even foiled a plot that was intended to replace me with a face dancer duplicate." Duncan stepped closer, his sword half raised. "It will be interesting to hear your testimony in front of an investigation board." "I think not." Fenring seemed to be losing his sense of amusement. He slashed out with his short sword, as if swatting a fly. But Duncan parried quickly. The blades clanged, and the short sword was deflected upward. But Fenring maintained his grip on its hilt. "You dare to raise a blade against the Emperor's spice minister, against Shaddam's closest friend?" Fenring was frustrated, though still slightly amused. "You'd best step aside and let me pass." But Duncan pressed forward, taking a more aggressive stance. "I am a swordmaster of Ginaz, and I have fought many Sardaukar today. If you are not our enemy, then throw down your weapon. You would be wise not to face me as an opponent." "I killed men before you were even born, pup." The laboratory fire continued to build. The hot air stank of roiling chemicals. Duncan's eyes stung and watered. Atreides' soldiers closed in to protect their swordmaster, but he waved them off, honor-bound to fight this one by himself. The Count pressed his attack. He usually killed through devious means, rarely in open combat against a worthy opponent. Still, he possessed many fighting skills that Duncan had not previously encountered. Lunging toward his rival, the swordmaster growled through clenched teeth. "I have seen too many casualties in this fight already, but I am not averse to adding you to their number, Count Fenring." He swung with the old Duke's sword, and his blade crashed against his opponent's upthrust weapon. Duncan fought with the finesse of a well-trained swordmaster, but with an edge of brutality. He did not stand on ceremony or chivalrous principles, unlike many of the swordplay instructors Fenring had heard about or actually met in combat. The Count held up the blade to defend himself, and Duncan swung down, concentrating great strength into a single blow. The old Duke's sword rang, and a notch appeared on the blade. But Fenring's weapon thrummed in his hand and shattered from the blow. The momentum knocked him into a wall. Fenring scrambled to recover his balance, and Duncan lunged forward, ready to deal the coup de grace, but alert for anything. This fox had many tricks. Options flashed through Fenring's mind. If he wanted to elude the sharp point of his adversary's blade, he could turn and run back into the raging fire of the laboratory building. Or he could surrender. His choices were indeed limited. "The Emperor will ransom my life." He threw down the hilt of his broken sword. "You wouldn't dare murder me in cold blood while all these men are watching, Still, Duncan took a menacing step forward. "What about the famous Atreides Code of Honor? What does Duke Leto stand for if his men are free to kill a person who has already surrendered, Fenring held up both empty hands. "You wish to slay me now?" Duncan knew the Duke would never approve of such a dishonorable action. He watched the laboratory burn and heard the continuing shouts of violent combat outside in the grotto. No doubt Leto could find ways to use this political prisoner to stabilize the imperial turmoil after the battle for Ix. "I serve my Duke before I serve my own heart." At a signal from the swordmaster, Atreides' men came forward and secured restraints to the prisoner's wrists. Duncan leaned close to him, his breath hot. "In the aftermath of this war, Count Hasimir Fenring, you may wish I had let you die here." The spice minister looked at him as if he knew a dark secret. "You haven't won yet, Atreides." It is no secret that we all have secrets. However, few of them are as veiled as we intend them to be. Peter de Vries, Mentat Analysis of Lansrad Vulnerabilities, Private Harkonnen Document. Under the leadership of Duke Atreides, the Imperial Guards spread out in search patterns throughout the palace grounds. Leto was anguished to leave a weak and exhausted Jessica alone, but he could not wait beside her while his newborn son was in danger. He shouted orders and tolerated no hesitation. As he stormed through opulent corridors and confusing mazes of prismatic mirrors, he thought of the ferocity of gaze hounds who fought to protect their young. Duke Leto would prove that a wronged father could be just as formidable an enemy. "They have taken my son." Haunted by memories of Victor, he swore by House Atreides that no harm would come to this child. But the Imperial Palace was the size of a small city, and had been designed with countless hiding places. As the fruitless search continued, Leto tried not to despair. Peter DeVries was accustomed to having blood on his hands, but now he truly feared for his life. Not only had he kidnapped a noble child, he had killed the Emperor's wife. After he had left Anirul's body behind him, he sprinted down the corridors, his stolen Sardaukar uniform disheveled and spotted with blood. His heart pounded and his head ached, but despite his extensive training, the Mentat could not reassess and develop a new plan for escape. The makeup on his face was smeared, revealing vivid sappho stains on his lips. The blanket-wrapped infant squirmed in his arms, occasionally crying, but, for the most part, remained surprisingly silent. Set into a fresh pink face, the young eyes burned with a strange intensity, as if this baby understood something beyond the capacity of a normal infant. He was so much different from the fussy, often annoying little Fade Ralpha. DeVries tucked the blanket tighter around the tiny body, tempted for a moment to turn the wrappings into a garrote. Suppressing the urge, he ducked into a dimly lit chamber filled with alcoves of trophies and statuettes, a room designed to show off prizes earned by some long-forgotten member of House Carino, who had apparently been a talented archer. With sudden shock, he looked up to see the silhouette of a black-robed woman who stood like a specter of death in the doorway, blocking escape. "Stop!" barked Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, using the full power of voice. Her command seized his muscles, paralyzed him in his tracks. Mohiam glided into the trophy room, the diffuse light shining like furnace flames on her fury. "Peter DeVries," she said, recognizing him through the smeared makeup. "I suspected a Harkonnen hand behind this." Struggling to crack the invisible restraint of her command, his mind spun. "Come no closer, witch," he warned through gritted teeth, "or I will kill the child." He managed to flex his arms and reassert a minimum of bodily control, but she could always paralyze him again with another utterance. DeVries knew about Bene Gesserit fighting abilities. He'd just dueled with the Emperor's wife, and had been surprised to defeat her. But Anirul had suffered from some kind of illness. The mental debility had given him an edge. Mohiam would be a much more formidable opponent. "If you murder the baby, you will die with him," she said. "You intend to kill me anyway. I see it in your eyes." DeVries took a small step forward, brash and defiant, to demonstrate that he had broken her voice spell. "Why should I not assassinate the Duke's heir and bring more misery to House Atreides?" He took a second step, clutching the infant to his chest like a shield. A quick jerk of his muscles could snap the small neck. Even with her Bene Gesserit reflexes, Mohiam could not be certain of stopping him. If he could just bluff his way past her and escape through the doorway of this forgotten room, he could run. Even holding a child, his muscles could carry him faster than this used-up woman would ever be able to go. Unless she had a weapon under that robe other than a poison needle, something she could throw or shoot. Still, he had to try something. "This infant is vital to the Bene Gesserit, isn't he?" DeVries said, stealing a third step. "Part of a breeding scheme, no doubt?" The Mentat watched for any jitter of her facial muscles. Instead, saw her long fingers flex. Those nails could become razor-sharp claws to slash his eyes, rip out his throat. His heart pounded. He raised the baby a little higher to protect his face. "Perhaps if you give me the child, I will allow you to pass," Mohiam said. "I'll let the Sardaukar hunters deal with you in their own way." She closed the distance, and Devries stiffened, every reflex at the ready, his eyes watching. Should I believe her? She touched the blankets with strong fingers, her gaze locked on the Mentats. But before she could draw the child into her grasp, Devries whispered hoarsely, "I know your secret, witch. I know the identity of this child. And I know who Jessica really is." Mohiam froze, as if he had used voice against her himself. "Does the horn know she's the daughter of Baron Vladimir Harkonnen?" When he saw her startled reaction to this revelation, he spoke more rapidly, knowing his deduction had been correct. "Does Jessica realize that she is your daughter as well? Or do you witches keep such things secret from your children, treating them like puppets in some genetic master plan?" Without answering, Mohiam snatched the infant from him. The twisted Mentat stepped back, head held high. "Before you move against me, consider this. Once I learned these things, I compiled full documentation and sealed it where it would be transmitted to Baron Harkonnen and the Landsrat in the event of my death. Won't Duke Leto Atreides be amused to learn that his beautiful little lover is the daughter of his mortal enemy, the Baron?" Mohiam set the wrapped baby down next to one of the archery trophies, in a velvet-lined alcove, under a saffron-colored light. He continued in a rush, intent on convincing her. "I made copies of these documents and secreted them in various places. You cannot stop the message from going out if I am killed." Devries took a confident step toward the door and his avenue of escape. "You dare not harm me, witch!" With the baby safe, Mohiam turned back to face him. "If what you say is true, Mentat, then I must let you live." Devries gave a sigh of relief. He knew the Reverend Mother could not risk the revelations. Even the slightest chance that he was not bluffing would be enough to stall her so he could get away. Suddenly, Mohiam lunged at him with the full fury of a wounded panther. She struck out in a blur of kicks and punches. Devries stumbled backward, trying to defend himself, raising a forearm to intercept a vicious slash with her foot. His wrist snapped from the impact, but after a quick, icy gasp, he mentally blocked the pain and swung with his other arm. Mohiam threw herself on him again, and he could not counter or even see every phase of her attack, a flurry of jabs and kicks and slashing blows. A hard heel landed at the center of his stomach. A steely fist slammed into his sternum. He felt ribs crack, internal organs rupture. He tried to scream at her, but only blood came out, staining his lips a brighter shade of red than the makeup-smudged Sappho. He lashed out with his foot, trying to crush her kneecap, but Mohiam slipped to the side. Devries raised his intact arm to block a driving kick, but this only resulted in another broken wrist. He turned to run, foregoing the fight, leaping toward the doorway and his escape route. Mohiam reached the door first. Her hard heel flashed upward in a blur and drove into his throat. The swift kick snapped the Mentat's neck like dry kindling. Peter Devries fell dead to the floor, his expression one of astonishment. Mohiam stood still, catching her breath. She recovered in only a moment. Then she turned to gather the rescued Atreides baby. Before walking out of the trophy room, she stood over the crumpled corpse on the floor, and allowed a sneer to cross her face for a delicious moment before erasing it. She spat on his dead face, remembering how he had leered over her during the Baron's rape. Mohiam knew there was no documentation of the secrets Devries had discovered. None. all of his terrible revelations had died with him. "Never lie to a truth-sayer," she said. An emperor's slightest dislike is transmitted to those who serve him, and there it is amplified into rage. Supreme Bashar Zumgaron, commander of Imperial Sardaukar troops. Before Shaddam could order his Sardaukar fleet to unleash their planet-destroying weapons, the Guild broke through to his secure comm channels and demanded clarifications and explanations. Standing on the command bridge of his flagship, the Emperor did not give them the satisfaction of an answer, nor even a justification of his actions. The Guild, and indeed the entire Imperium, would have their answers soon enough. Beside him, Supreme Bashar Garon stood at the control station, logging acknowledgments from the warship commanders. "All weapons ready, sire." He looked down at the screen, then at his emperor, who studied him. The weathered old veteran's face was implacable. "Awaiting your order to fire." "Why can't all my subjects be like him?" After being ignored, the Guild legate transmitted a solido hologram image onto the flagship bridge. Tall and imposing, larger than life, he said, "Emperor Shaddam, we insist that you cease this posturing. It serves no purpose." Irritated that the Spacing Guild had been able to penetrate his security, Shaddam frowned at the hollow image. "Who are you to decide my imperial purpose? I am the Emperor." "And I represent the Spacing Guild," the legate replied, as if the two things were of comparable importance. "The Guild does not determine law and justice. We have pronounced our judgment. The Baron is guilty, and we will impose the penalty." Shaddam turned to Zumgaron. "Give the order, Supreme Bashar. Proceed with the full bombardment of Arrakis. Destroy every living thing on the planet." On a ledge outside the cool, dry tunnels of Redwall Siege, the boy Leet Chi woke up, restless. Only 4 years old, he rolled off the mat on which he had been lying and looked around. The night was warm, with barely a breeze. His mother, Farula, rarely let the children sleep outside, but she and the other Fremen had activities in the darkness, on an open shelf of rock. He saw shadowy shapes moving in well-practiced silence, desert people bustling about with efficient movements, making no unnecessary noise. Barely visible in the moonless starlight, his mother and her companions opened small cages of Distran's bats, releasing the creatures to fly high and far, carrying messages to other sieges. Behind the Fremen workers, door seals held moisture inside the hidden warrens of the siege, where some communal chambers held production areas, looms for weaving spice fiber, still-suit assembly tables, plastique molding presses. Those machines were silent now. Farula looked at Leet Chi and, with eyes accustomed to the darkness, saw that her son was safe.